From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Palestinians mark Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, Tuesday. 70 years ago, the State of Israel was founded and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians fled or were expelled from the territory. At least two more Palestinians were killed Tuesday in protests along the Israel-Gaza border, a day after nearly 60 died and hundreds were wounded. Israel has come under withering international criticism for its lethal use of force, but Israel's UN ambassador Danny Dannon defended his government's actions.
Rioters have thrown Molotov cocktails, planted explosive devices, and rolled burning tires. They have sent flaming materials over the fence, igniting widespread fires on Israel's southern agricultural lands. They have repeatedly attempted to forcibly breach the fence and infiltrate Israeli territory with the explicit goal of killing Israelis.
The Palestinian UN envoy, Riyad Mansour, condemned what he called Israel's odious massacre. He also demanded a transparent, independent international inquiry into Monday's violence. Burundians go to the polls third day to vote on a referendum on sweeping constitutional reforms that could keep President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034. Dio Gamba with the group Enact said the government is seeking legitimacy.
And that is what is behind the whole political crisis, is because the government is not legitimate. So the referendum is going to give it constitutional and legal legitimacy.
Rights groups charge the campaign period, like the last 3 years since the president announced a third term in 2015, have been marred by intimidation and abuse. This is VOA News. North Korea canceled Wednesday's high-level talks with South Korea, suggesting the planned June 12 meeting between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump could be in jeopardy over ongoing joint U.S.-South Korean air combat drills and what it called one-sided demands for denuclearization. The official Korean Central News Agency denounced the nearly two-week exercise as an intentional military provocation, to which U.S. spokesperson Heather Nauert professed surprise.
Well, they're certainly not provocative. These are things that we do all around the world with many of our partners and allies. These are things that have occurred for decades and decades. Again, I'll say this for a third time, Kim Jong-un had said that he understands the importance to the United States that we conduct these joint exercises. These joint exercises continue to go on.
The high-level Korea meeting Wednesday was to discuss reducing border tensions and possible reunions of families separated by the Korean War. Seoul called the North's decision regrettable. European countries vowed to keep the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement alive after the U.S. announced earlier this month it was withdrawing from the pact. European diplomats discussed next steps with their Iranian counterpart, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, in Brussels.
I believe we are on the right track. Now, a lot depends on what we can do within the next few weeks.
Meanwhile, the U.S. announced new sanctions targeting the Iranian central bank governor for providing millions of dollars to flow to Hezbollah through the Quds force of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Afghan security forces, backed by Afghan and U.S. airstrikes, appear to be gaining the upper hand following a fast-flowing Taliban assault Tuesday on the remote western city Farah. The insurgent attack was launched in the early hours of the day, with Taliban fighters using heavy weapons and night vision equipment to swiftly overrun several districts. The assault followed several high-casualty bombing attacks in the capital, Kabul. Jailed Malaysian politician Anwar Ibrahim is a free man today after being granted a full pardon following last week's surprising election outcome. He was driven to the palace in Kuala Lumpur for an audience with King Sultan Mohammed V. The 70-year-old Anwar has been serving a 5-year prison term for sodomy. Russian President Vladimir Putin Tuesday presided over the opening of a new road and rail bridge linking Russia to the annexed Ukrainian territory of Crimea. Mr. Putin was at the wheel of an orange heavy dump truck and drove over the bridge. He was met with cheering workers on the Crimean side. Ukraine's president denounced the bridge as cynical. Russia annexed the peninsula in 2014. U.S.-based cereal maker Kellogg pulled out of Venezuela Tuesday, citing the country's social and economic deterioration. Its manufacturing plant was seized by leftist governments of President Nicolas Maduro, who vowed to turn it over to the workers. The move came just days ahead of Venezuela's heading to the polls for national elections. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. urges electoral reforms ahead of this year's Zimbabwe presidential vote.
We have seen some progress to date. We have been very pleased with a lot of the words we've been hearing, a lot of the promises and pledges we've been hearing, and we're just looking forward to implementation of those.
Jennifer Savage is the U.S. is the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Harare. South Africa withdraws its ambassador to Israel amid U.S. Embassy move. 100 Cuban medical personnel are due in Kenya sometime this month. Thousands flee Mali's Mopti region due to violence. And Sierra Leone police reflect on the stadium stampede during President Mada Bio's inauguration.
I will not call it an investigation that we've launched. We are reflecting to what actually happened. We are looking at what we could have done better and what should be done in the future to prevent such occurrences.
Ibrahim Samura is Sierra Leone Police Superintendent, and a court orders Nigeria's Senate to end its suspension of controversial Senator Ove Omo Agege. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United States says President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government needs to take action on its promises to conduct free, fair, and credible general elections this year. This comes at a time when some Americans are already in the country preparing to monitor the forthcoming general elections to be contested by more than 120 political parties. Gip Dube of U.S. Zimbabwe Service reports.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa has promised that the Southern African nation will conduct free, fair, and credible elections this year following the removal of former President Robert Mugabe from power last November in what Mugabe has described as a military coup. This will be the first time in 38 years that Zimbabwe will be conducting the elections without Mugabe. America has already expressed its willingness to make some amendments to the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act if Mnangagwa's government conducts free, fair and credible elections. Against this background, Jennifer L. Savage, charged the affairs at the United States Embassy in Harare, on Tuesday met with Speaker of Parliament Jacob Mtenda to assess the promised electoral reforms.
We had great conversation learning about the progress and the state of electoral law and the reforms in the electoral law. And we're happy to hear that the law is progressing. And with that, we look forward to that progress made on not just the electoral reforms, but we look forward to hearing more and having further conversations with the Honorable Speaker about economic reforms, about reforms on the human rights front, on the governance front.
Asked to comment on preparations for Zimbabwe's forthcoming general elections, Savage said President Mnangagwa's government has not yet implemented its promises that will enable the country to conduct free, fair and credible elections.
We are looking forward to more progress. I think we have seen some progress to date. We have been very pleased with a lot of the words we've been hearing, a lot of the promises and pledges we've been hearing, and we're just looking forward to implementation of those. We do talk about that what we're looking for is not just about elections. Elections are an important step, but we are looking forward to elections on a number of pillars, the economic reforms, human rights reforms, and good governance reforms as well. So I think we are seeing, hearing all of the right things and need to see some action following up on those promises made.
Some opposition parties are not happy with the electoral law, saying it is skewed in favor of the ruling ZANU-PF party. On the amendment of Zimbabwe's electoral law, Savage would not be drawn to comment any further.
It's still under consideration. I think we'll reserve judgment until it's final.
Indications are that the United States is eager to see a transparent election this year, as the country is in the process of deploying its observers. Savage noted that some Americans are already in Zimbabwe preparing for the forthcoming general elections expected to be held between July and August this year. Savage also said the United States is helping Zimbabwe in many sectors, including programs focusing on tackling HIV/AIDS. America and other nations imposed targeted sanctions on Mugabe and his inner circle following claims of alleged vote rigging and human rights violations. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, I am Kip Stube in Washington, D.C.
South Africa has recalled its ambassador from Tel Aviv after Israeli forces killed at least 59 Palestinian protesters during demonstrations against the U.S. embassy's move from Tel Aviv, where most foreign embassies are based, to the disputed city of Jerusalem. As viewers Anita Powell reports, South Africa's action is in line with the historically troubled relations that other African nations have had with Israel.
Free Palestine! The 100 or so protesters who gathered outside the United States consulate in Johannesburg on Tuesday say they support South Africa's decision to withdraw its ambassador over Israeli forces' violent reaction to protests during the relocation of the U.S. embassy. South Africa's Department of International Relations and Cooperation condemned the actions of Israeli forces against pro-Palestinian protesters in Gaza, saying the victims were taking part in a peaceful protest against the provocative inauguration of the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. That violence, they said in the statement, prompted them to immediately withdraw the ambassador from Tel Aviv. Among the protesters in Johannesburg Tuesday, many of whom wore shirts that read Free Palestine and End Israeli Apartheid, was a small clutch of people who identified themselves as members of a group called South African Jews for Free Palestine. This young woman, Rosa, asked us not to use her full name.
It's a really important move for South Africa to start taking a stand. South Africa, you know, was crippled by apartheid. And as Nelson Mandela said, South Africa can't be free until Palestine is free. And I think it's really important that the South African government is hearing the voices of people who are saying, we can't just watch, we can't just let children get murdered. We can't let civilians get murdered. We have to do something. And this is, I guess, a small symbolic gesture where they're starting to do something.
The South African Jewish Board of Deputies, a much larger group, disagrees. National Director Wendy Kahn said the group was disappointed by the ambassador's withdrawal.
We believe that nothing can be achieved by shutting down a diplomatic channel. South Africa has a history of negotiation and dialogue, and we believe that in so many ways they could have played a role in terms of resolving this really awful conflict.
South Africa's reaction is the strongest to come out of the continent, but it is not new or surprising, says analyst Alfred Majaya Dube of the Institute for Security Studies. The divide, he says, dates back to the Arab-Israeli wars in the 1960s and 70s, which coincided with the early days of independence for many African nations.
I think as the years passed, Africa's position on decolonization was very clear. And therefore, by extension, there was a very strong feeling that Israel was in violation of various resolutions of the United Nations about the occupied territories. And therefore, a resolution of the Organization of African Unity was that African states would not have diplomatic food or those who had to break relations with Israel over the question of the occupied territories.
That stance persists. Today, Israel has just 11 embassies on a continent of 54 countries. And the African Union has admitted the Arab League as the only non-African member state and allows the body to address the bloc at its annual summit. And when the United Nations voted overwhelmingly last year to reject the United States' move to recognize Jerusalem as the Israeli capital, only one African state, the tiny West African nation of Togo, voted with the United States and Israel. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Today is Wednesday, May 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. 100 Cuban medical specialists are set to arrive in Kenya in about 2 weeks. This follows the signing this week of a memorandum of understanding between the two countries. The Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists, and Dentists Union has criticized the move as unethical because it says there are enough doctors in Kenya. Kenyan Health Cabinet Secretary Cecily Kariuki says the doctors will be distributed across the 47 counties in Kenya for a period of 2 years. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Speaking during the signing of a memorandum with the Council of Governors, Health Cabinet Secretary Cecily Kariuki says that the doctors have already been scrutinized and even the Master of the English Language approved. Ms. Kariuki says that doctors will be operating on a two-pronged approach, service delivery and capacity building of the local doctors through mentorship and working alongside other physicians in Kenya in health sector.
Getting the 100 Cuban specialists is a process that has undergone rigorous pre-selection and peer review by the medical practitioners and dentists board. The board has vetted and found qualified doctors, 100 of them, who will be able to speak English and are therefore able to serve our local population. Cuban doctors shall be deployed to all the counties for a period of 2 years. On the other hand, the 50 medical officers who will be going to Cuba and who we are on target will undergo a 2-year postgraduate training, again emphasizing on family medicine. They will return home as family specialists.
The move was well received by governors who say that the initiative aims at boosting the country's medical sector. The Council of Governors Vice Chairperson Anne Waiguru and the Chairperson of Health Committee, who is also Governor for Isiolo Mohamed Kute, assure the ministry of their commitment to implement the move in their respective counties.
In this connection, county governments have recorded notable strides in the health sector and brought services closer to the public, including the specialized care for which Kenyans used to travel long distance. After several consultations between national and county government, the process of sharing and distribution of Cuban medical specialists has recently been concluded, and each county will receive at least 2 doctors from Cuba based on their availability and need.
However, Kenyans welcome the move with different views, as others feel that the Kenyan doctors could have been given an opportunity and get trained as specialists in medical sector.
It has positive and negative, because to me, when we are going out there to look for doctors and yet we have the capacity to train, there are so many institutions in Kenya which can train doctors. Why don't we train our own?
Oh, I think that is a really good idea, because currently as we are, we have a doctor's issue. If using doctors from outside the country is going to help the situation, then why not?
Earlier, before the deal between Kenya and Cuban doctors was sealed, the Kenya Medical Association, KMA, and Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union, KMPDU, opposed the move. KMPDU Secretary General Oumo Luga has asked the Health Ministry to employ more than 1,200 local doctors before considering Cuban doctors. Kenya joins Uganda in East Africa to have Cuban doctors work in the country. The move by Kenyan government was arrived at after Kenyan doctors paralyzed services in Kenyan public hospitals for 100 days last year. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jambu in Nairobi, Kenya.
A court orders Nigeria's Senate to end its suspension of controversial Senator Ovi Omo Agege. Senator Agege, along with other senators, were suspended by the Senate in April for their opposition to an electoral reform bill. The Senate accused Agege and another senator of helping the thugs on April 18 to invade the Senate chambers and steal the Senate maze, the symbol of authority. But a high court this week said the Senate had no legal authority to suspend one of its members for misconduct. Senator Sabi Aliu Abdullahi is chair of the Senate Committee on Media and Publicity. He says the Senate is a law-abiding body and will respect the court's ruling after the appeal process is exhausted.
We have said in our press release of yesterday to the effect that as an institution that is a democratic institution, and indeed the face of democracy itself, we are law-abiding, we respect the courts, and since there is a pronouncement, we have sought legal advice, and our lawyers have advised accordingly. And to that extent, we have said the court has ruled that the suspension is not proper, and so we should resume. And we agree with the judgment to this effect, even though there is an appeal for both the judgment and even the stay of execution, as I was briefed by our principal officers.
But, Senator, which one comes first? Did the Senate summon Senator Agege and his accomplice to come to a Senate committee for investigation, or does the court judgment supersede the summoning of Senator Agege?
Well, as it is, we have already issued a press statement to the effect that he is free to resume, and we have nothing against that. So that's what takes precedence. But all we are saying is that this is an appeal and also application for stay. But until those things are heard and the court rejecting it or granting it, we have no problem for him resuming, as we have issued in our statement.
I guess what I'm saying is that there's a story that said that your Senate has summoned the senator to come before a committee to answer to some of the allegations. Does the Senate have the right to do that now that the court said you cannot suspend him?
What allegation now?
The allegation is that he played a part in the invasion of the Senate chamber, which led to the disappearing of the maze. And he was supposed to come to answer these allegations.
The invasion of the, hallowed chamber, as far as we are concerned, is the worst thing that has happened to us this far. As a democracy, from the presidency to judiciary, everybody condemned that act.
The court has ruled that he cannot be suspended. I mean, does the Senate have any other remedy, or you are going to let this particular case just go away?
Well, as it is, the court has ruled, but like I told you, that issue is being appealed. And until this issue gets to the highest court, I'm sure it is still an issue that can still have a different judicial interpretation. But we are not the first. I will allow the judiciary to do its own part. Now, be that as it may, what I want to submit here is that action where the hallowed chamber of the red chamber was invaded and the maze taken away in a very, very brazen display of thuggery. I think it's something condemnable. And if there's an allegation against anybody, already we have very high assurance from Mr. President, Commander-in-Chief of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, President Muhammadu Buhari, that issue is to be investigated. And I'm sure the whole essence is for us to know what happened so that we can prevent a repeat in the future.
Senator, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much for having me. My pleasure.
Senator Sabi Alio Abdullahi is the chair of the Senate Committee on Media and Publicity. He was speaking with me from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Sierra Leone police say they have begun reflecting on the stampede that took place during last Saturday's inauguration of President Julius Mada Bio. At least one person died and 98 others wounded, according to the Sierra Leone Red Cross Society. One report said over 50,000 people packed the stadium built to accommodate 45,000 people. Police Superintendent Ibrahim Samura says the purpose of the reflection is not to persecute anyone, but to learn what exactly happened and what should be done to prevent future occurrences.
The meeting was organized simply because we wanted to look into exactly what happened at the national stadium and what were the challenges that we actually faced as a law enforcement institution, and what could be done better to prevent such occurrences in the future. And a committee is already looking into what actually went wrong at the National Stadium on the day of the inaugural ceremony of His Excellency Julius Mada Bio.
Mr. Superintendent, I must say that probably this was an embarrassing situation for the police in Sierra Leone, given that this was the inauguration of your president and too many heads of state were there. What happened? In other words, what's the capacity of the stadium and how did it come about?
Well, I will not describe the incident as embarrassing. I will describe it as one that was rather unfortunate, because the national stadium was actually filled to the brim. Sierra Leoneans were eager. Sierra Leoneans were anxious. They were anxious to meet with their president. They were eager to meet with their president. They were eager, to witness the inaugural ceremony. They were eager to see the different head of state, because it was a colorful occasion. And as a result of that, the number of people that actually turned out, was absolutely overwhelming. And the incident which actually occurred by the swimming pool. The swimming pool of the National Stadium, there is an entrance there, and the gate right on the entrance actually fell off because the people were so many and they were trying to make their way into the National Stadium. They rooted the gate. It was made of iron bars and it fell on some of the people. Few people were unconscious, but later they recovered. But unfortunately, one person died in the process. A lady by the name of Aisha Conte died in the process. But had it not been for the robust security measures put in place by the Sierra Leone police, of course, it would have been a different story.
Mr. Superintendent, the investigation that the police have launched, is it a criminal nature? In other words, what are you going to do with the results? Are you going to prosecute some people or what?
I would not call it an investigation that we've launched. We are reflecting to what actually happened. We are looking at what we could have done better, what actually went wrong, and where did we as an institution, a security institution, went wrong, and what should be done in the future to prevent such occurrences. How could a national stadium be better secured so that such occurrences would not be repeated? Because even some police officers sustained injuries in the process, so not only civilians. So we are looking at what could be done better to prevent such an occurrence.
Mr. Superintendent, thank you very much. We are so happy to have you on Daybreak Africa. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Ibrahim Samura is Sierra Leone Police Superintendent. He was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. Increased violence in the Mopti region of Mali has caused thousands of people to flee their homes, according to the Norwegian Refugee Council. Head of Programs in Mali, Dumitil Gali, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the worsening cycle of violence and its effect on those living in the Mopti region.
And now, like, we are facing a rise of violence. So there is no specific trigger. The last few weeks or months, it's really an escalation of violence. There are four group of villages that have been affected in Koro. It's also worrying because the conflict is spreading more and more in Koro and in the other circles at the border.
It says that hundreds of houses have been burned down. What kind of information were you guys getting from these families about the reasons behind these clashes?
It's quite complex. I began saying that for these specific clashes last few weeks, there is no specific trigger. It's much more a cycle of retaliation. Like, it's very dangerous because a cycle of retaliation, like, never ends. So now the both communities are currently looking for some support to ensure their own security. But what we in the field realized is that, like, right now, before, we say since last June until now, it was much more armed group of specific communities that were fighting between them. So it was violent, but it was between armed groups. Right now, we are facing, like, the civil society and the community, like, civil people are directly affected and even more than affected with all the villages burned and the cattle killed. At least for our team in the field, their understanding of the situation is like that now the escalation of violence is like bigger and bigger and bigger. The cycle of retaliation is overwhelming even the armed group. And they didn't realize that their own community would be affected at that point.
They thought it was just going to be between armed groups, but now it's seeped into the fact that they're attacking houses, civilians, etc. Is that what's going on?
Absolutely. And there is not one specific trigger.
What do you think the next steps are? I know, again, it's very complex and it's kind of hard to see where to go next, I'm imagining, but what could improve the lives for these people who have had to flee?
Yeah, so they flee all the families from like 10 to 15 kilometers. So the first emergency aid will be given this week. So it has been a little bit delayed because of security access, but now we have an access from both communities. Then what we are suggesting is that security in the zone is more and more complex. And so the both communities, the civil population, is more and more afraid of going out even to their own fields. And right now, it should be, so if it's not done now, because of security access, like the food security situation will be worsening in the next few months.
That was Dumitil Gali, head of programs for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Mali. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Liberia's capital, Monrovia. And that is it for this Wednesday, May 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, as Burundi prepares for a May 17th referendum to extend President Pierre Nkurunziza's time in office, it battles allegations of harassment committed against perceived opponents of the referendum. Critical times in Burundi on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.